Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. On today's episode, I made a decision that I wanted to talk about how we learn to lie to ourselves. So it's an episode about truth and learning how to tell the truth.
Dr. Dana Saperstein in the Fear Me Out podcast is pleased to announce that Janus Community Counseling Services is now the proud sponsor of the Fear Me Out podcast. Janus Community Counseling Services is a nonprofit organization in Santa Barbara, California, that is committed to providing professional, affordable counseling. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to the podcast. For more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.
I invited Justine Hamilton, who is my dear co-host here today, to kind of facilitate the conversation. I'm a little nervous, I have to be honest, about doing this episode because the only way I could think of to do it was to talk about myself on a very personal level and how I learned to lie to myself at a very early age and how those lies affected my life until I had enough therapy to kind of heal those lies and learned how to be more truthful about who I am. So I'm going to start off by talking about the lies that I learned to tell myself based on my relationship with women and then with men. So welcome, Justine.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Keyword therapy. It's always the keyword, right?
Yeah, therapy, right. I've been thinking a lot about doing this podcast and I wasn't sure if it would hold people's interest. So I apologize ahead of time if I bore you with all the details of my life, but it's the only way I know of to talk about how I learned to not be truthful with myself.
That's probably the bravest thing that you can do is come on and talk about that to an audience. And first of all, you know, acknowledging that you have lied to yourself, because I think most of us go through life never acknowledging that. And then being willing to talk about it, I think it's really brave. So even if you think it's a little boring, you're doing a service.
Okay. Well, I know I've talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into great detail, but even before I was born, I learned to lie to myself. And I've talked about this experience I had when I was in utero at about 6 months of age, and my parents were having a fight, and my mom believed that my dad was having an affair because she was ugly. And I have a very crystal clear memory of believing that that ugliness was my fault. Mm. And that because she was pregnant with me, mm-hmm. I was destroying the marriage between my parents, and that it was my fault that she saw herself as an ugly person. So I have a very clear memory of absorbing her ugliness through the umbilical cord into my body.
When did you first have that memory?
Probably when I was in my 30s. I was doing hypnosis and I started to feel, I was working on GI troubles that I've had in the course of my life, and I started feeling this really horrible feeling on my stomach. And then I just had a crystal clear memory of this situation.
Under hypnosis.
Yeah. And I remember after I had the memory telling my wife, and, you know, it's kind of you know, you can't remember stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the proof I have is that a year later, she was having lunch with my mom, and I never talked to my mom about this. And my mom just spontaneously told her the same story I told.
Wow.
Like in the same exact detail that I...
That when she was pregnant with you, they had a fight.
Yeah, because my dad was having an affair.
Wow.
Now, the only thing my mom didn't know was that I took in her ugliness. Mm-hmm. So that lie, I was born with that lie that I'm a bad person because I make my mom ugly.
Isn't that remarkable that you could take that in utero?
Oh, I remember it so clearly coming through the umbilical cord. And I actually, you know, when you do hypnosis, sometimes you sort of see visual images, and the energy was so dark and awful, like disgusting.
Yeah.
Because my mom did have a lot of pain, not because of me. I mean, I was hardly even there yet, but it sure felt like it was my fault. You know, being a really empathic, sensitive person, I really believe that it was my fault that, you know, her life was such a mess.
Yeah.
I was born allergic to her milk and wasn't able to sustain myself. And so I almost died the first 3 months of my life because they couldn't, I couldn't get any nutrition.
Wow.
Until they figured out that goat's milk was the answer. So
pretty
as
symbolic.
Soon as, yes, as soon as I stopped trying to, you know, breastfeed, I sort of recovered from that. But I never really felt a very vital connection to my mom throughout most of my life. And that first lie, I really believe, affected me in very deep ways for a lot of my life, actually. I remember when I first became interested in girls, like in junior high, I really felt like I was an incredibly ugly, unattractive, and brought nothing to the table person. When I got my seventh grade yearbook, I took a pen and I scratched my image off the, because I just thought, I can't look at my picture. I'm too ugly. I'm too awful.
Wow.
And there was no way in the world that I could, I had girls that were friends, but there was no way in the world I could approach a woman in any romantic way because I just absolutely was certain that I would be rejected.
And so do you think sort of the ugliness that your mother felt, that was passed on to you, or?
Well, I think I took it on as my responsibility.
That
she was losing her husband because of me.
Right. But then you also felt ugly.
Well, because that ugliness was living inside of me and I couldn't tell the difference between her ugliness and the energy that I took from her into my body.
So when you were a kid and you'd pass by a mirror or get your photo taken, or do you remember?
I was really shy and never really spent much time looking at myself physically. And on top of that, when I was 4 and a half, I got molested.
Right.
And that was a horrible experience. And that was so traumatically painful that I really believed that I was being killed when I was being put under anesthesia. And the lie I told myself at that moment was that it's my fault that this guy did this to me and that I didn't deserve to live.
Wow.
And so by the time I was like 4 and a half years old, that was a disaster.
Yeah. But didn't really understand why, right?
No, I had no idea. I mean, all I know is that I got hurt a lot. I was a pretty wild kid. I got hit in the head by a baseball bat when I was 3, and that sent me to the hospital.
Ugh.
And I used to, like, I spent a lot of time in the emergency room because I would be so reckless and out of control in that way.
Do you think you're trying to hurt yourself?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. All I know is that I absorbed that ugliness as if it were mine.
Yeah.
And the lie that I told myself is that I was ugly and unattractive and that no woman would ever want to have anything to do with me.
And you really believed that?
Absolutely, yes. I all the way until I was in college, I never went out on a date unless the woman approached me.
And you really felt like, I am ugly? Like,
well, I was just so shy and so self-conscious and I never understood why my friends had such an easy time and that it was so painful to me. And I really did not see myself as having any sort of physical attractiveness
at all. Did people ever tell you that?
Yeah, people would tell me I was handsome and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I just, you know, I didn't believe them. I just didn't. Because it didn't, that those truths didn't match the lies that I felt. Because, you know, on top of those major events, my mom was pretty disconnected. So we didn't really have much of a connection with each other through most of my life. And the only time I could really get her attention was when I provoked her to the point of such extreme anger that she sort of jumped into her body for a brief moment. But it was all so negative.
Right.
Because she lived in complete anxiety and terror all the time. Because my dad was a really terrible husband. And, you know, he was unfaithful his whole marriage to her, yet she hung around.
Yeah.
And continued to, you know, try to make things work with him. I'm not sure why. I think she was just too afraid to be alone.
Yeah. And did she, what was it like being with her? You said like you'd do something so terrible so she would get back in her body. Was she just distant? Was she mean? Was she?
No, she was just sort of, she acted stupid, even though she was brilliant. But the way that she handled her femininity and her herself as a woman was to act like an idiot, basically. Mm-hmm. And my father would tell her all the time how stupid she was.
Wow.
And she never argued because I think she believed that it was true.
Yeah. Lie she told herself.
Yeah. And, you know, again, he didn't treat her with any kind of respect.
Yeah.
And, you know, she didn't respect him either. She'd tell him what a fat pig he was, and he'd tell her, what, you know, how stupid she was. And that was their way of showing affection to each other.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre.
Sounds lovely.
And, you know, there was a lot of desperation because my dad was really volatile in his ability to make a living. Mm-hmm. You know, we left Canada because he was going to go to jail.
Right.
And so we had to flee the country. And my mom, you know, had a lot to deal with. My little brother was like 2. And I was, you know, I actually was less than 2. And I was, you know, 3 years older. My sister was a couple of years older than that. I don't, you know, she couldn't handle it as an adventure.
Yeah.
It was just too overwhelming to her.
Yeah.
So, again, she just felt like she was a victim. And my job was to rescue her from my terrible father.
Yeah. That was the other lie that you were telling yourself.
Yeah, and it didn't work because no matter how much of her pain I took into my body, she was never able to relax.
Right.
It was either complete anxiety or panic, and that's how she just went through her life.
And did you spend your, like, teen years and older trying to fix her, trying to reassure her, trying to take her pain away?
Well, during my elementary years, the way that I handled my vulnerability was to be extremely violent as a way of trying to feel like I had some control over my destiny.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got old enough to realize I was hurting people, then I turned to drugs.
Right.
And kept myself completely numb from 13 to about 18.
Yeah.
Wasn't a single day that I wasn't high during all that period of time, from morning to night.
Right.
So I never really felt anything other than lonely and depressed.
Yeah.
And luckily I had a lot of friends, so I was distracted by my friends, but it didn't really helped that they had such an easy time with women, and I was like crippled.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. Yeah. How to negotiate that world. What I didn't understand during all of this period, my dad was being unfaithful, because I didn't think he cared about women at all. But what I really came to realize is, you know, he had multiple partners. I was surprised, actually, when I did DNA testing, that I didn't have a bunch of half siblings all over the world that I'd never met.
Yeah.
So.
And so your mom's pain just continued on, and you just continued to take that on.
I felt like that I was being consumed by her all the time, but that was my role, was to let her use me to sustain herself. So some of the friendships I developed with women, especially, were with really damaged women who I took care of, in a way.
Because mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that's just the model that,
right.
that I grew up with.
Right.
And the biggest lie that I would tell myself is that I was unlovable, that there was no way in the world that anybody would ever want to be with me.
And that you were there because you had to save them
yes.
or take care of them or yeah. something.
It was not pleasant. I'm not saying that I didn't have moments of pleasure, because my parents were not horrible people. I mean, we did have lots of fun growing up in some ways. They loved baseball, and so it was very cool to share that with them.
Yeah.
My dad got me my first surfboard. That was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, that it was all dark.
Right.
But
do you think your mom ever knew that you felt like this?
No. No, because I tried to talk to her about it as an adult. And she looked at me like I was crazy.
And you said, I've spent my life taking care of you. And
yeah, and I'm not doing it anymore. I told her I was retiring from taking care of her. I actually got to a point where I had to tell her that if she ever spoke my father's name in front of me, that I would never speak to her again. Because at this point, they were already divorced by 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom never got a divorce. My dad went on to have another family.
Right.
And my mom was dating and seeing men and stuff like that. But she never got over, in quotes, what my father did to her.
And so even when you're an adult, she's yeah. still pulling you back in.
Oh, she complained endlessly about what my dad did to her.
To you.
And I just couldn't take it anymore. After
did she
a while.
Do it to your siblings?
No, I was her special friend in that regard. I mean, she did it a little bit with my brother and sister, but I was the chosen consumable.
Why do you think that was?
Firstborn Jewish kid.
Firstborn.
Male. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wasn't the firstborn in the family, but women in male, my mom's yeah. eyes were not valuable. So my older sister
Right.
Didn't really have much value to my mom.
Right.
So as a, you know, as a male.
Yeah.
And I was pretty feisty. So I think that, you know, there was a part of who I was that that appealed to her in some ways.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth. As much as I tried to talk to her about this stuff and work it out, it was like talking to a blank wall. Wow. Just never could do it.
So how did those lies, like how did it perpetuate everything in your life?
Well, I was extremely sick a lot as a kid, GI-wise. Mm-hmm. Left over from all of that, I think.
Yeah, your body so reacting.
I had chronic diarrhea all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was uncomfortable, obviously. Yeah. And I think I just kept that pain inside my stomach.
Right.
And, you know, I took it out in the form of violence to try to find some way of feeling like I had some power and control.
Yeah.
So the lie I told myself eventually is that the only way to feel strong is to hurt other people, which my dad encouraged mm-hmm. because he believed that the world was divided between perpetrators and victims.
Right.
And that you had to choose whether you were going to be a victim or a perpetrator, and there was nothing in between. And he would say that to me almost every day.
Wow.
Because in his life, he was victimized horribly by his family, especially his mom. And so he came into the world.
Fighting.
And, he had to turn to being a criminal to make a living because he didn't go past eighth grade.
Yeah.
And he was a really smart guy too. And unfortunately, he used his brilliance to be a mastermind in the criminal world.
Not so smart.
And until he got his own therapy, mm-hmm. he would destroy all the fortune that he would make.
Mm-hmm.
So therapy really helped him not to stop being a criminal, mm-hmm. but to help him keep the money that he stole.
Right.
So he died a very wealthy guy.
And did he ever, because you said he got therapy, so did he ever understand these lies that were inherent in you that came from either one of them?
Well, I would say that he was able to take some responsibility, not for my relationship with my mom, because they weren't together anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. they separated shortly after starting therapy, and but he was able to at least intellectually understand that his absence was really painful to me.
Yeah.
So he did apologize a lot.
Yeah.
And we cried together and did whatever we could to try to heal our relationship. But he was pretty narcissistic in his own way. And mm-hmm. so he could only get to a certain point of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And he never gave up the idea that you have to be a perpetrator in order to be strong.
He never gave that up. Yeah. Well, that was pretty ingrained in him, right?
Oh, very much so.
Did he ever talk about some of the lies that he told himself?
No, we didn't have those kind of conversations. Yeah. I mean, we had a lot of conversations about personal things, but he didn't have the insight to realize that that maybe he was self-destructive.
Mm-hmm. And it was much later in life, right? Where he
did
his therapy.
Yeah, and he'd already started another family.
Yeah.
So, and he found a woman that was just a few years older than me that he married and had another kid with. So he sort of started over and did a redo.
Mm-hmm.
I will say though, when I left Canada as a 5-year-old, we were on the run and ended up in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were smart enough to realize that they couldn't take care of the three of us very easily without some help. And so they actually hired a nanny to, come and take care of us. And I will say that that was a miracle because the woman that came into my life, I fell madly in love with her and I know how much she loved me. And it was the first time in my life that I actually felt real love mm-hmm. coming from an adult.
Wow.
And so I followed her around like a duckling.
Yeah.
Everywhere she was, when she was at her house, I was on her heels all the time. I just always wanted to hold her hand and be with her all the time.
Yeah. And you were what, 4?
I was 4 and a half. Because she was so lovely and so present.
Yeah.
And my mom was in such a panic that she was just in another world all the time. And so I just followed this woman around everywhere and was so, so in love with her. And she really taught me what love felt like.
Wow.
And I didn't really understand at the time that that was like a miracle.
Yeah. Yeah, someone was watching out for you. You needed that.
And you know what the weird thing is? I was in her life for 9 months.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, we were together for 9 months before my parents had to leave Brazil in a big hurry.
Yeah.
And I, for the life of me, I did not understand why they didn't take her with, because she was my real parent.
Yeah. Right? You had to have been devastated.
I could have lived without my real parents because I was so, I just wanted to be with this woman all the time because she was so lovely.
Even when you were that age, it was just it was
love at first sight in that way. I mean, obviously there was no sexual anything about it at all.
Yeah.
But she was so warm and loving and amazing.
And there was no jealousy from your parents that you were so
I think
connected
my mom was
them.
Insanely jealous, and I think that's why they left her behind.
Really?
I don't think she was conscious of it.
Wow.
But I can only imagine what it would be like to be a mom and look at your son, 5-year-old son, mm-hmm. just adoring mm-hmm. this person and never seeing that look coming your own way.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that was probably painful to her.
Do you remember any interactions between the two of them?
My mom was nice to her because she kept us alive in a lot of ways. You know, she'd go to the market and get food and, you know, she knew Brazil.
Right.
She was a refugee from Hungary or somewhere, Yugoslavia or somewhere like that.
And were your brother and sister the same with her?
No, it's just me.
Just you.
My brother was really little, and he actually was quite sick. He almost died from the measles while we were there.
Oh, gosh.
And my sister was just kind of, you know, doing her own thing.
Yeah.
So it was really me and this woman. And I remember sitting at the airport when we were flying away from Brazil, and we were sitting in a coffee shop, and there was classical music playing. And I was dying of a broken heart.
Oh.
So to this day, I can't listen to classical music without wanting to sob.
Wow.
Because I so associated with losing this woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think I remember asking, come on, we got to bring, her name was Kruna, we got to bring her with us. And they were looking at me like, why? She's just the maid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or whatever it was. But I just felt like I couldn't live without her. So,
and these are like memories that you had from 4.5 on. These aren't repressed.
Crystal clear
that came
memories.
Back.
No, I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially being at the airport and leaving her behind.
Yeah.
And so, again, what that, the lie I told myself is that you can't trust love.
Mm-hmm. Because you had to leave her.
Yeah, because it's going to be taken away from you if you open your heart.
Right. So, let's see. I've made my mother ugly. I'm ugly.
Uh-huh.
I can't trust love.
That's right.
Man.
It was not so good.
I would not want to have been the girl that you were interested in at that point.
Well, it made me feel just so bad about myself.
Yeah, that's sad.
I just had no self-esteem at all in that regard.
Was there any area of your life where you could live outside of these lies that you were telling yourself? Where like,
yeah, I mean, I had lots of fun with my friends because I've always had a good sense of humor.
Right?
I always made friends really easily. So I did have a ton of fun with my friends.
What about like professional or like teachers were teachers like, oh, he's a great kid or no. Okay, not teachers.
I'm sorry to
Never
laugh.
Mind.
But here's what school was like. When my brother, who was 3 years younger, would be in a class that I or my sister and I were in previously,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Please tell me that you're not related to Dana or Julie. So
right, not teachers.
I had no respect for authority at all. I was taught by my dad that people that had authority were idiots and you don't need to listen to anything anybody says.
Yeah.
So I was a royal pain in the ass.
Yeah.
I was a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But I was also really able to fool my friend's parents into thinking I was the innocent one.
Oh.
So whenever there was a problem
and
we were going to get in trouble, they would look at me and say, well, we know you're not involved.
Uh-huh.
And I would have this sheepish smile on my face like, of course I'm not involved.
Right. No,
and I was the ringleader.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I learned how to sort of charm my way through certain situations.
Really had to.
But then the loneliness never left. I was always, and the depression was so extreme that I just had to be medicated all the time.
And so, I mean, I can't imagine when you left that woman in Brazil, like how.
I was heartbroken, devastated.
Yeah.
It was, I have such clear memories of all these things. And so then we came to California, and the first few weeks that we were there, I was crossing a crosswalk and got hit by a truck. And the truck hit me, and I flew up in the air and landed on my butt on the street. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I didn't really get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But I got up from that assault, and I thought that it was my fault.
What?
And obviously the guy that was driving the truck was really worried. So he started chasing me down the street to want to make sure I was okay. But I thought he was trying to finish the job.
Oh my gosh.
I thought he was there to kill me.
And you're five.
I'm seven at this
point. Seven at this point.
And so I'm running down the street and my brother's behind me, hitting him, this guy. Leave my brother alone, because my brother didn't know what was going on. He was four.
Right, right.
And we didn't understand that the guy was just trying to make sure I was okay.
So you got hit by a truck and thought that it was your fault.
Yes.
Because you weren't worthy to be
I didn't
here.
Have any other thoughts than I must have done something wrong because I just got hit by a vehicle.
Wow.
So that's how I started school in the United States, because this was the summer before starting elementary school. And that was a very painful time because I didn't want to go to school. Mm-hmm. I was too afraid to be there. So they would drop me off in second grade and I would run away from school. And finally they said to me, if you keep running away from school, we're going to put you in kindergarten because you're acting like a baby.
Oh.
So they shamed me into submission.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't stand up to do the Pledge of Allegiance and I wouldn't sing during the choir part because I started my rebellion, right?
That's where it begins.
That's right. I wouldn't listen. I wouldn't do it. And luckily they were kind enough to not be too harsh with me. But I will say that when I was in Brazil and we left, I saw people being killed because there was a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to second grade, the teacher asked us to write stories about what we experienced over the summer. So I wrote a story about watching soldiers kill people. And the teacher was beside herself when she read the story. And she called my family and my mom and said, hey, there's something wrong with your son. His imagination is really awful and violent.
Oh, gosh.
And I'm sitting there thinking, this is the truth. I'm telling the truth. She wouldn't believe me that it was true.
Did your mom stick up for you?
No.
She didn't?
No, because in those days, absolute authority, teachers ruled.
Didn't explain, listen, we just left Brazil and there was a revolution and this is what he said.
No, she would never do that because she would have to go up against the teachers. They just couldn't. They just were, you know, they just respected teachers in that way back in those days.
Wow.
So it was not a very pleasant experience to be told that I was crazy for writing the truth.
Well, and was there anyone in this time period of your life that stuck up for you?
No. I made friends, luckily. I made some really dear friends.
What about parents? Like, what about some of your friends' parents who are like, God, this poor kid is wounded?
The fathers of my friends would encourage me to fight.
Well, that's not very healthy.
Well, that was what we did in those days, was fight each other. So there was no support in that way. And I'm not sure what their mothers thought of me. I think they were always nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they were capable of really sort of, I think they all had their own problems that they were, you know, they don't want to get involved with some kid who's.
But there was no one at your school or, I don't know, forget teachers, but a counselor or just, I don't know, just an angel just going, this kid needs some help.
No, because when we left Canada, we left all of our relatives behind. And my parents had no contact with any of their siblings. So I never grew up with cousins or and they didn't have any contact with their parents.
Yeah.
So I had no grandparents and no aunts, uncles and cousins. Yeah. We were completely, and my parents had a couple of friends that they made, but I didn't have anybody that was looking out after me.
Yeah.
I really had to take care of myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wasn't prepared, that's for sure.
No.
Not in any significant way.
Well, and you just kept believing these lies that, you know, from the beginning that you didn't even know were lies.
Yeah.
And just perpetuated how you lived your life.
So by the time I was 19, I'd moved away from home. I left home about 2 weeks after high school because I hated living with my parents and I hated living in Los Angeles. I want to live at the beach.
Mm-hmm.
So
did you start to figure out, I know you're high all the time, but did you start to kind of figure out like these people are screwed? Like they're,
yes,
this is not where I should be.
I did a little bit of therapy at the end of high school.
Okay.
Like a couple months. And I realized that maybe I wasn't as big a problem as I thought I was.
And
so that was sort of the beginning. And I just stopped getting high. I just put it all away.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a miracle. But unfortunately, I moved to San Diego. And within a month of living there, I went to the store and came home to police cars in front of my house. And what happened was that a guy robbed a grocery store. And because our door was open, he ran in our house when my roommate's sitting in the living room. And the police came in and killed him in our living room.
killed the robber? Robber.
Yeah. So I come home and my friend's in a police car and I go in the house and there's bullet holes and
oh my
guts and blood all over the place. And that was my introduction to moving away from home. And I just thought, this world is fucking nuts.
Yeah.
And I was really scared. It was awful. And my friend ended up leaving, moving back home because he was so traumatized by, you know, he's running out of the back door and somebody's getting killed right behind him.
Yeah. Oh my
gosh. So then I move into another place. And this is the morning of the first test that I took in college. I look out the window and the SWAT team is in front of my apartment building, pointing all their weapons at the house in front of us. And I'm eating breakfast and I'm watching. It was like watching TV, except it was real.
What do you mean?
This man walked over to the pier, which was down the street from where we lived, knocked on a policeman's window. The policeman rolled down the window and he shot him in the face and killed him. And then he ran and hid in the house across the street from us. So I watched the police, you know, have a shootout with this guy. Yeah. And they wounded him and pulled him out of the house. And they beat the shit out of him like you can't even imagine.
And you saw all this?
The whole thing.
Oh, God.
And this was before I was supposed to take my first tests in college. Yeah. I'm like, what the, you know. And I call my roommate, you got to see what's going on here. So we're like ducking and looking out over the window while there are bullets flying around all
You're
over
like,
the place.
My parents are whacked, but at least no one's getting killed there.
So, I mean, again, it just reinforced the idea that the world is not a stable place.
Yeah.
And I can't really count on any kind of security.
Can't.
No, I will say that I had really dear friends at this point in time.
Thank God.
And I'm still friends with these people.
Yeah.
You know, 50, 60 years later. So I think that they saved me.
Yeah, they had to have because it was not going your way.
Because we loved each other and had a really fun time together.
Yeah.
And that was really very sweet. And one of my friends and I actually, in the middle of going to college, moved to Hawaii so I could surf. And and that's actually where I met my wife, on the beach. Mm-hmm. So in between the weird, horrible stuff, there were miracles happening, but I didn't understand that they were happening at the time.
Yeah.
When I look back now, I think, boy, that was amazing what happened.
Yeah.
That brought me to her. Right. Amazing.
I mean, there was a purpose in all of it.
Yes. So, you know, the horrible stuff was horrible. I couldn't really digest the good stuff because I had no spiritual sort of life at all.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that there could be such a thing as God or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
I was very antagonistic when it came to, because like most people, I thought the religion and God were the only way to, and I hated my religion. It was horrible because I was forced to participate against my will.
Right.
And it was awful.
Well, and I'm sure it's so easy just to focus on the negative, all the negative stuff. Like those memories are the ones that stand out, you know, someone getting killed and SWAT teams and everything else, that you don't even see, like, this is all leading to a better place.
Well, and my father and my mother used my mother as a weapon to force me into my religion. Because I would beg and plead with them not to make me go to Hebrew school, not to make me go and do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, I'll do anything. I beg you. I'm on my hands and knees. I'll do anything to please you. Don't make me do this. And my dad would say, do it for your mom. So if I wouldn't do this for my mom, I was a piece of shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had to do it.
And why did you hate it so much?
Because I was shamed into submission.
Well, all kids, I shouldn't say all, most kids hate Hebrew school or, you know, I had to get confirmed. I didn't want to go there on Wednesday nights. Like I wanted to hang with my friends, but I wouldn't have been so against it like you were. I would have just gone like, fine, it's an hour. I just won't pay attention. I'm going to McDonald's after. Like you hated it.
You know, I've always been a pretty intense person, emotionally intense. Nobody would ever call me California Mellow. I'm not that. It's really strong feelings about everything.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't just eat it and do it.
Yeah.
And I remember telling my Hebrew school teacher, I fucking hate this. I'm doing this because my parents are forcing me.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I'm going to tell them because you shouldn't be here. And I said, don't you dare. I'm going to go through all this shit and you will never see me again.
Yeah.
And I will never step foot in a temple for the rest of my life. I just have to put up with this crap because I'm being made to feel horrible if I don't.
Yeah.
So I did eventually concede to it. And, that, you know, sort of a very brief, funny story. The day of my bar mitzvah, I'm standing up at the you know, in front of the place where you stand, and they take the Torah out of the case that it's in.
Mm-hmm.
So the rabbi opens the door and he can't get the Torah out. So I'm trying to help him and he pulls it really hard and it bangs into my head in front of everybody in the whole temple. Sees the Torah bang me in the head.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning of our mitzvah. And everybody's laughing. And they thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. And I, when I look back, I think, you know, that was so
symbolic. Like,
symbolic.
I mean, if we're going to get this into him one way or the other.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
So funny.
Yeah.
So again, you know, I know my first girlfriend was not a, it was not a good experience for me.
Yeah.
Because
probably her either.
Well, I fell in love with this girl and she was so beautiful. And it was so bizarre because I remember coming home from school one day and this absolutely drop dead gorgeous girl was in my bed.
Oh, hello.
And I walked in the door and I thought, what are you doing here? And she was a friend of another girl that my roommate was going out with.
Mm-hmm.
I think, why is this girl in my bed?
And how old were you?
I was 18.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, oh my God, she's one of the most gorgeous creatures I've ever seen. What is she doing in my bed? And for some odd reason, she decided that she wanted to be with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I, God, I fell so in love with her. It was ridiculous. I think I fell in love with the idea that somebody actually would be interested in me that looked like her.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so we were together for about a year, but I found out after a while that she was sleeping with everybody in town.
Oh.
So again, the what I learned from all of that is that you can't trust women. They're going to lie to you.
Yeah.
And they're going to use you. And then when they're done with you, they'll walk away. So I'm not sure it really stood much of a chance as far as all that goes.
No, that's...
For the life of me, I don't understand how I met my wife as a 21-year-old and fell so in love with her and how it all worked out.
And this was... very much therapy, right? This is just a little bit of therapy.
I had some therapy, yeah, but not like I did when I moved to Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
And I spent a decade doing really intense therapy.
So how was, like, how did you, because your wife is wonderful, and mm-hmm. how did you unravel sort of all of these notions that you had about yourself and all these lies and all the negative towards women and keep Susan to stick around?
Well, she didn't stick around at first.
Smart.
She followed the pattern. Because when I first met her, we were in Hawaii, but she was already previously engaged.
Okay.
With another guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the attraction was so strong that we just completely lost control.
Mm-hmm.
But she was there with her sisters and they told dad, and dad told boyfriend who showed up in Hawaii.
Oh gosh.
And my wife felt so guilty, so horrible that she said, I'm sorry, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
I begged her to run away with me. Mm-hmm. I'd only known her for 2 weeks and I was ready to spend the rest of my life with her.
Wow.
Because I was so drawn to her.
Yeah.
And so she left and I never thought I'd see her again. And I was completely destroyed by that experience, even though I'd only known her for a couple of weeks.
And she was... How many women were there in between the first one and Susan?
Nobody that I was ever really very interested in.
Yeah. So this was the other second big kabow moment.
But it was so brief.
Yeah.
And then I left Hawaii and moved to Isla Vista to finish school. And for some odd reason, I started attracting lots of women. And so I was having a pretty fun time, actually, mm-hmm. during that period of time because... I had a bunch of different women that were willing to make the effort to be with me.
And were you, how were you thinking about those lies that you had been telling yourself?
I wasn't. I was too busy having fun.
But were you like, I got this wrong? Or
I was, no, there was no thought about it. I think that, you know, I found a therapist when I first moved to Santa Barbara who was my mentor and saved my life.
Yeah.
So being connected to him made me brave.
Yeah.
Because he was really so instrumental as a man in my life that actually showed me that I was worthy of being loved. And he was just such an amazing man. So I started having the courage to open my heart a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really lovely.
And was he really the one that kind of helped you understand all these lies?
Yes. Yeah. We didn't necessarily classify them as lies,
mm-hmm.
but he helped me understand that so much of my suffering was not my fault and that I didn't do anything to cause it to happen. And that I was really horribly victimized in many, many horrible ways.
I mean, that's the key, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, that's why we tell the lies.
Yes. Yes. So he was just a remarkable person. I have such fondness for him.
Yeah.
And he's the one that convinced me to become a therapist. Mm-hmm. So I was suffering a bit less. But the molestation that I suffered was still buried inside of my soul. So there was always a part of me that didn't believe I deserved to live. And I always had a background of really deep depression that was really hard to get rid of because I really didn't feel like I deserved to live.
Even after working with him for a bit.
Yeah, because the molestation, the idea of being sexually abused never came up in the therapy.
Right.
Ever.
And you didn't know.
I had no idea that that's what was driving my self-loathing and my terror of being close. But I was really lucky because after a year or so, Susan recontacted me. And I just bailed on all the women that I was having fun having because I really didn't care that much about them. And we started hanging together and just fell madly in love with each other. No, she was in San Francisco, but eventually moved here. And, you know, we've been together ever since. We both were in therapy during that period of time. And that's what made the difference. We were able to kind of negotiate all of our, especially my, you know, weirdness by getting lots and lots of help.
And I mean, we've told these lies to ourselves for years and years and years and don't even really know why or how or that we're doing it. So how much therapy or how long did it take for you to really kind of unravel all of that?
I had 10 years of twice a week therapy and some of that was group therapy on top of it. So it was a lot of therapy and then hypnosis on top of that. I was a mess. I really was a disaster. Plus, I loved therapy. I thought it was the greatest thing ever.
It is great.
I so enjoyed it. And I just found it so fascinating and so relieving.
But even though, okay, we, you know, you get through all of that and you, we understand that like, it's not our fault. Like these lies that we're telling ourselves, it's not our fault. It's, you know, we are not this person. These things have been done to us. But that that takes time, right? So how, what does that look like? I know lots of therapy, but is it just continuing to kind of talk through it? Or how do we finally get to that place where like, okay, you're right. This isn't my fault.
Well, it took lots of crying and lots of despair and lots of acknowledging the loneliness and telling the truth about how I really felt about everything.
That's the hardest part,
Yeah, because it was hard to tell someone that I hated myself and that I thought I was not a lovable person, especially when he was so kind to me and so loving toward me.
And did you know that? Meaning like you could feel that in yourself or did it come through like...
I could feel his love for me.
No, but I mean that, that you really hated yourself.
Oh, it was so clear to me. Always. Through my whole life, that I was not a lovable person. There were lots of times that I felt like I should kill myself. I never actively tried. I didn't ever come up with a plan, but I can't tell you how many hours I spent thinking, I think I should just kill myself. Because I was in so much despair and loneliness. I never told anybody. Nobody knew anything. I never told anyone about any of this.
And would anyone ever have thought that about you?
Never. No. No, just like now, I suffer intractable physical pain. And most of the time, people tell me, oh, you look really good. And I think, yeah, I'm a good actor. Right? I can act like I'm okay because I learned to do that from the time I was a little kid. And it's I don't feel bad about that. I think it's okay. I don't want to walk around looking miserable and and complaining. I think that's incredibly unattractive. And I made a decision. I want to live. So why focus on the negative?
So there are some lies that we tell ourselves that can be beneficial.
Yeah. Or at least to do the best you can not to give in. Because I don't want to give in. I want to live a very intentional life. And I want to fight for what is important to me. Because if I gave in, I'd be in a fetal position in my closet. Because I don't wake up any day ever not in excruciating pain. It's there always. So I just have to deal with it. And I don't like taking drugs or any of that. So I just have made a choice that I'm going to live this way. And, you know, it does get the best of me sometimes. But mostly, I can be okay. I think I am, and underneath all of this, a very strong person. And a resourceful person. But, you know, life has not been easy, that's for sure. You know, I've had to deal with a lot of horrible physical stuff. I lost my sister to cancer. That was really devastating. And again, another situation where I loved a woman incredibly deeply and she died.
Mm.
And I knew she was going to die because she smoked like a chimney her whole life. And I would plead with her and beg her to please stop because I knew that she was going to die, but she just couldn't.
Yeah.
And so she died at 51, which was horrible.
That's so young.
So, you know, there's shit that happens in all of our lives, and I appreciate that. I will say it's been easier to forgive my dad than my mom because he was more able to take responsibility for the pain he caused.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're looking for. It's just someone to understand and to hear and to acknowledge. Yeah.
Well, at my mom's funeral, they all wanted to go have a meal to celebrate her life. And I told my wife, I can't go. I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot go celebrate my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking away from the gravesite and I was overcome with the most intense scream I think I've ever made in my life. I hate you. I screamed that so loud. And I don't even know where it came from because it was not a planned event.
Wow.
And I just remember looking around thinking, fuck, I hope nobody heard me. Because that insane feeling of hatred was so, I felt like I was 4 years old again.
Wow. And was that after therapy, during therapy?
Oh, it was way after.
Way after.
Yeah.
But you still had these feelings inside of you.
Well, because in some ways, my mom continued to try to feed off of me until she died.
Right.
And the only kind of relationship we could have was talking about the Lakers or the Dodgers.
So would you just stay away from her, basically?
Uh-huh. I wouldn't let her touch me.
Yeah.
And I never told her I loved her because I didn't.
Right.
Which was, you know, a lot. I got a lot of flack for that, especially from my wife, who said, you're so mean. You're so, she's just a pathetic old woman. And I agreed that that's what she was, but not to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because she saved her special behavior for me.
Yeah. And did she have, like, did other people see through her, like your brother, your sister?
Well, my sister in her deathbed, my mom came over because we told her that she was going to die imminently. And we asked my sister, do you want to see mom before you die? And she had not spoken a word for 2 days. She was just kind of in a coma.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked her that question. She opened her eyes and screamed at the top of her lungs, fuck no.
Wow.
Those were the last words that came out of my sister's mouth on her deathbed when it was time to
for
my mom to come in and say goodbye to her.
Yeah.
She woke up from a coma to scream those words. I just thought, holy shit, this stuff never ends.
No, we reap what we sow.
Oh, God.
Oh, my gosh.
I felt a little bit bad for my mom because, you know, her daughter and how I can't even imagine losing a child.
And you told your mom then you can't come.
Well, I told my mom that I'm not going to take care of you because I want to be with my sister. Because
mm-hmm.
my mom wanted me to take care of her. It never stopped.
Wow.
It's your job to make sure I'm okay because I'm losing my daughter.
Ugh.
And my response was, no, you need to come and take care of your daughter because she's dying.
Yeah.
But she just didn't get it. It was not her fault.
Right.
She was so broken.
Right. Right. I mean, that's the
thing. So I do understand that part.
Yeah.
And it's so weird we're having this conversation because just today at lunchtime, my wife said, do you think maybe you'll ever be able to forgive your mom?
She said that today.
Uh-huh.
And your mom's been dead how long?
10 years.
And what did you answer?
My response was, you know, I'm not sure because there are times when I never think about her ever.
Mm-hmm.
She never comes into my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But when I do think about her, I feel such a sense of emptiness and betrayal.
Yeah. But can you think about it in just an empathetic position?
I try really hard because I try to be as empathetic as I can. I pride myself in loving people, but for some reason, the it's like living with a human vampire that masqueraded as a victim.
Yeah. Well, she was your mom. Like that's a really strong bond. And she.
But there was no bond.
Right. No.
That's the weird part.
Yeah.
Is that I feel like I have no internal representation of a mom.
Right.
And yet the woman that I chose to be with is so amazing, such an amazing mom and person. I don't know how the fuck any of this happened.
But that's not surprising, right? Like that's what you needed.
But I will say that the miracle of meeting this woman, Kruna, in Brazil is that she left an imprint inside my body of love.
Yeah.
And Susan is a spinning image of this woman, except facially. They have the same body.
Oh,
and the same energy.
Yeah.
So I was so attracted to that again. tall, thin, really sort of poised person.
Yeah.
So I think that even though I lost her after such a brief period of time, her impression was indelible inside my soul. And I knew what to look for.
Yeah. That was the only thing that you knew that was right. Uh-huh. It was love.
So fooled her.
Yeah.
I got to marry up. Because we've been together for a long time. Aww. And we still seem to really love each other.
That's so nice.
And I will say at this point in my life, I don't feel like I lie to myself in any way that I'm aware of.
Oh, that's interesting.
I don't feel like I'm an ugly person. I don't feel like I'm unlovable. I feel like I'm allowed to enjoy life and that, yes, I have some really deep issues of physical pain I have to deal with, but I try the best I can not to let them destroy the goodness I have because I have the best life anybody could ever want. Yeah. And I think to myself, how did I get here from such a dark, self-loathing place?
You knew how you got here.
I worked hard.
Yeah.
But I figure if I can do it, anybody could do it. Right. And I know people have had things happen much worse than me.
But I don't think most people go through life trying to figure out how they can kill themselves or think that a car hit them on purpose or, being molested at a young age or having a mother that you have zero bond with. Like, that's all pretty gnarly stuff.
That's the way it feels to me, I will say. But at the same time, I do believe we have a choice.
Yeah.
And having a spiritual life helps a great deal.
Right.
Because another miracle that happened was that a woman came into my life and helped me understand that there was such a thing as God.
Yeah.
In a way that even Mr. Major Cynical, couldn't deny.
Yeah.
And it changed my life in such a radical way. And I am eternally grateful to her for helping me understand the lies I was telling myself on a spiritual level.
Yeah. Yeah. That's huge.
So there's been a bit of a balance, I guess, in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, you had to start low to go high, right?
Well, I'm not sure if I really understand how the universe works. So all I know is that it's been quite an interesting life.
Well, and once you're aware, too, of how it, or not that you're aware, because none of us are aware, but if we have an inkling of there is a greater force out there, we just notice it more and see it more and respond to it.
Yeah, I don't feel like I'm special. I think what is maybe unique about me is that I have a very adventuresome, in a certain way, spirit. Mm-hmm. Even though I like things to be predictable, I like when things are weird and unusual.
Yeah, you're open and you're always reading those weird magazines.
Books and, And I sit in my hot tub hoping to be abducted by aliens.
That's weird.
I think what greater adventure could you go on as long as...
I don't care. I don't want to go on that adventure.
I know, but what if you didn't get hurt? What if it was
Who cares? I want to stay in my hot tub.
Okay, well, I sit there and think, okay, take me, but you got to bring me back because I don't want to leave my family.
That's right.
Just take me for a ride because I want to see what it's like because I want to know what it's like.
Yeah, I think you got that from your dad too.
Yeah. Yeah, he would fly tiny airplanes over the Amazon.
Yeah, daredevil.
He was in a certain way. I only can imagine what life would have been like for him for both of my parents, if they weren't molested as kids and they weren't tortured in anti-Semitic ways and didn't live in the worst poverty that you could ever imagine. Yeah. They would have killed it.
Yeah.
Because they were really smart, conceivably capable people, but they never stood a chance.
No, it's so sad. You broke free. That's huge.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing to me because when I look at my kids and what a charmed life they've had, I don't think they've ever been molested. Certainly nobody's ever hit them. I haven't ever hit them, and I try to be as present and loving toward them as I can.
Yeah.
But I think even then, I'm hoping that their kids will exceed their life because I think that's evolution and process.
It's supposed to get better every generation.
Yeah.
If we do the work.
So, I've not fully healed my fear of my mom. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I carry her pain inside my body anymore. My stomach's actually for the last decade or so been really pretty good compared to other parts of my body.
Thank God.
Yeah. So
that's good.
It feels like those things have relatively resolved.
Yeah.
I mean, I can talk about being molested and I have no emotional charge attached to it at all.
Yeah. But that's huge.
Yeah. I feel like it's been healed.
Yeah.
And that I'm really grateful. And I think that my version of God, which is a non-religious God, that's amazing for somebody like me. Because if you knew me, you would think this is the most irreverent person you could ever meet, right? Such a smartass and so anti-anything.
Yeah.
Could feel that kind of a connection. I marvel at it. Like, how did I do this? Because it's so unexpected.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure sometimes if my kids know what to do with me, because I don't really talk that much about God, but I think that they, you know, certainly hear it through the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I try really hard to, when people come to see me, to open themselves up to this idea that you can speed up your healing process if you can allow yourself to have a spiritual connection.
Yeah.
And it can be totally irreligious.
Yeah.
That's the best part for me, because I'm not a joiner. I'm not a, you know.
Right. I think that people get so caught up in that it is a religious uh-huh. thing. And if they can get away from that and just understand how the universe is working and helping, then they can heal faster. I mean, uh-huh. I know it worked is working for me in my life.
Well, you know, Justine, the funny thing is that if I had a choice, I would not allow men to be in any positions of power. I think that women should run the world.
I wish.
So for a guy who was, you know, terrified of women and very untrusting, I really believe that women have a quality that is hard for men to possess, and that as leaders, the compassion would be so much stronger.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so I want women to be in charge, but I know that's not going to happen. Yeah.
Not quite yet.
Too many men that are terrified of giving up control.
Yes. And it starts from the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not where we are right now.
So I guess in a lot of ways I've healed the woman part of the lies.
Yeah. The parent-child bond, especially through the mother, is supposed to be so strong. And if that's severed, you're kind of screwed unless you can figure out a way to heal it through therapy and whatever else. But
well, and I see how my precious daughter lives in the world. Mm-hmm. And I want her to know, as I do want my son, but in a different way, to know how much I love her.
Yeah.
Because she's my girl.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, the other night I just spontaneously texted her saying, "Don't you forget, you're my girl."
Aww.
And that I won the lotto when it comes to having a daughter. And it just felt so lovely to be able to say that.
Yeah.
And we have such an amazing bond.
That's so nice.
And I feel the same way about my son. He's a very lovely person in his own way.
Yeah.
And so I am really lucky as far as being able to at least fool them into thinking I love them. I'm joking. No. I hope they know I love them.
They do.
So I'm not sure what else to say about the female side of things. I think I'm going to do another podcast on talking about the lies that I learned in relationship to men.
Okay.
Because they were different.
Yeah.
Very different. But
I've
also...
Men and women are very different, right? And are just like your relationship with your daughter is different than your relationship with your son.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
They are two different things.
Uh-huh. So... You have any questions before we finish?
I don't have any questions. I think it's just remarkable that we tell ourselves these lies and don't even really know it or understand it and live our whole life doing it. And then when we can get to the other side and understand it, and then again, it goes back to the whole thing where like, it is not your fault. Like, this is not your fault, what was done to you, and that you believed all these lies about yourself. And once we can finally get to that it's not our fault and it's not us, then the healing can begin. And there's so many people out there that just don't really understand. It's not their fault. Uh-huh. It's not their fault.
Well, and if I can get a little, airy fairy or whatever, if God is love, that means that all human beings are created in love.
Yeah.
And I think if we could accept that, then we are not our trauma.
Right.
And that telling ourselves that we're not worthy and that we're inferior and that we don't deserve love is such a profound lie based on the fact that we're created in love.
Right.
And that all the guilt and all the shame and all the, you know, sin and all that crap that gets imposed on people is a way to control them. It's all about using fear to hurt people instead of using love to help them.
Yep.
So I guess the idea that I try to get people to recognize that you don't have to live in fear and you don't have to let these horrible things define your value. They are horrible things and you can heal them. And you can free yourself from the symptoms that they create. Because I don't have much anxiety or, you know, I certainly don't feel a ton of fear in my life.
Yeah.
And that's really lovely because that's certainly not the way I grew up, no. You know.
No, and it just, it starts with the first step.
Yeah.
And it can feel overwhelming, but it's just, you know, every day, just a little bit, a little understanding, a little therapy, a little whatever, just to get there. And it definitely feels overwhelming, but it's okay. It's, you've got one life and one love and you need to do the work.
Just preach to the choir.
Yeah, I know. I'm talking to myself.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Justine. I really appreciate your willingness to listen to all of this. I hope it was okay.
It was great. It was great, Dana.
So we'll do it again.
Sounds good. Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember, if you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to this podcast. If you need more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.